Good morning. My name is Canon Zappa, and on behalf of the Cathedral of St. Philip and Contemplative Outreach, I would like to welcome you here today for this wonderful time of retreat with Cynthia Bourgeau. And with no further ado, I'd like to introduce Roberta White from Contemplative Outreach, who will be introducing our speaker today.
And good morning. Oh, thank you, Canon Zappa. And good morning to everyone. I understand there's over 400 people here today. Yes, it's wonderful. Well, thanks to each and every one of you for coming here to spend a day with Cynthia Bourgeau and hear Reverend Cynthia share her wisdom and talk about her book, The Heart of Centering Prayer, Non-Dual Christianity in Theory and Practice. First, on behalf of Contemplative Outreach of Atlanta, we want to thank the Cathedral of St. Philip for co-sponsoring today's conference. It's been a pleasure working with Canon Zappa and Jeannie Mahood in planning for this special event. And I also want to recognize Rusty Weitzel and our Contemplative Outreach of Atlanta coordinator and our leadership team who have also been in on the planning from day one. I want to take this opportunity to encourage you to visit our information table over there in the corner where we have brochures regarding Contemplative Outreach, as well as the Method of Centering Prayer, a pamphlet on that, and upcoming events. Reverend Cynthia is not a stranger to the Atlanta area. She was here at St. Philip's the first time in 2013 to talk about her book, The Holy Trinity and the Law of Three. And over the years, she has led retreats at the Monastery of the Holy Spirit in Conyers, Georgia. We are very fortunate to have Reverend Cynthia back here today. In 2015, we started talking about a speaker we would like to come to Atlanta. We reached out to Cynthia Bourgeau, hoping to schedule an event. It's in 2015. And she said she would love to, but she was booked for the next 2 years. But to give her a call back sometime, and we did in 2016. And she said, oh, she had some dates available in 2018. So we put our heads together, and here we are, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, 2018. As many of you already know, Dr. Reverend Cynthia Bourgeau is an Episcopal priest. She is also a teacher and a retreat leader. She has taught and led Centering Prayer conferences and retreats nationally and internationally for more than a decade, including in San Diego, Birmingham, Denver, New York, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and coming up in late April, which is next month, Reverend Cynthia, in South Africa. Oh. She is the author of two books on centering prayer, one being Centering Prayer, An Inner Awakening, and the one she will be speaking about today, The Heart of Centering Prayer. She has written several more on various other aspects of Christian mystical and inner tradition, including mystical hope, the wisdom Jesus, the Holy Trinity and the Law of Three, and the meaning of Mary Magdalene. Reverend Cynthia is the founding director of the Contemplative Society in British Columbia and the Aspen Wisdom School. She now serves as a core faculty member together with Richard Rohr and James Finley for the Center for Action and Contemplation in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Reverend Cynthia's home is in Maine, and increasingly, these days, as she says, on the high seas. Reverend Cynthia is here today to share her wisdom and her latest book, The Heart of Centering Prayer, Non-Dual Christianity in Theory and Practice. Father Thomas Keating, the founder of Contemplative Outreach, describes her book as, quote, a masterpiece of spiritual wisdom, firmly rooted in the Christian mystical tradition, a brilliant analysis of non-dual Christianity in theory and in practice, and a major contribution to the Centering Prayer movement and to inter-spiritual dialogue. Again, we are glad that all of you have come here today to spend a day with Cynthia Bergeau. Let's all welcome Reverend Cynthia Bergeau and welcome back.
I can see you all. Let's see, we got, can you hear in the back? Okay, we're good to go. So it's absolutely wonderful to be back with you all again. I can get to say y'all again. They don't do that too much up in Maine. And yes, to deal with things quickly so you're not all wondering, that is a boot on my leg. I had a little boating accident about a month ago, which is about healed up. And I discovered today when I put on my dress shoe that the heights match. So I'm not swaying anymore. So enough of the physical world. Our purpose today is not just to have a conference, but to have a day where we're actually doing some of the practice. So there'll be a couple of periods of centering prayer and work in the midst of it, at least this morning, that may not come out on the schedule too clearly. That we had a little reverser, a flip around on the schedule. And if you could just make this correction so it doesn't confuse you, all the times that you have there are exactly right. But I'm going to launch into the first presentation right now. And then you'll have your break at 10:30, just like it says on it. And then you come back at 10:50, but what you come back at 10:50 for is not a talk, because we'll have done that already, but a period of about 20, 25 minutes of centering prayer. Because for me, and what I've discovered over and over and over again, is that the work of centering prayer, when you're in a challenging format like today, where we're going to be going through a lot of information in a very short period of time, people just can't absorb anymore. And centering prayer is, among its other profound charms and values, a wonderful way of allowing the mind to just let go of all this grabbing at content, relax deeply, and hear in a different way. I was amazed. I've been reading, just for the fun of it, Bernadette Roberts' last book. And it jumped right out to me on a page. She says, silence is a way of knowing. And so we're going to observe that way of knowing, certainly after the break. And when we come together in the afternoon, we will also have a little bit of centering prayer interspersed as we gather in the afternoon, not a full sit, but enough to get us settled down and once again into that contemplative receptive frame of mind. So do be aware that we are in a retreat format, although that might not be obvious for your schedule. And also in the spirit of a retreat format, take the space you need in your own day to regulate your own balance between silence and conviviality. You know, if you find there's a time you just want to go out and kind of do a little meditative walking, particularly at lunchtime, there's a beautiful labyrinth right over there across from the cathedral. There's beautiful grounds. Spring is going. So don't feel like you have to chat everybody up every moment. That the material that I'm going to be doing here, I'll be breaking out in greater detail with about 60 lucky souls who signed up for a 2.5-day retreat we're going to be doing over at St. Ignatius House, that will sort of take on this material at a slower pace and with more time for intentional prayer and absorption. So this gives you all the kind of fast-forward trailer, but let's sort of still do it in an atmosphere of retreat, spaciousness, And mindful, of course, that St. Patrick is hovering over us today, reminding us that the thing that perhaps needs greening more than anything else is the greening of our own heart in so many ways of turning it inward as a really spacious and verdant place of deeper listening, deeper compassion, deeper solidarity with our planet, and deeper solidarity with our world. So let's let St. Patrick and his beautiful, all-encompassing, forgiving vision be with us as we do our work today. Okay? Enough said. The real purpose is to give you a quick and dirty tour today, overview of my latest book, Centering Prayer and Inner Awakening. And to say just a few things about it to get it oriented is that it's, you know, it joins its place with the book I did sort of 10 years earlier, this is the Heart of Centering Prayer. The other one was the Centering Prayer and Inner Awakening. And they're actually quite different, not only in the fact that there's 10 years that separate them, but they have distinctly different purposes. That the Heart of Centering Prayer is not really intended as a manual. It's not how do you do centering prayer. I do have a first section in the book that takes you through that really quickly. But it's really quickly. And if you're wanting to learn how to do centering prayer in chapter and verse, using my sort of reference points, that the book to go to is still Centering Prayer and Inner Awakening. That what this one really is it's an inquiry into and a reflection on how centering prayer and the practices of it fits, you know, within the greater spectrum of meditation, and also what light it sheds on the well-hidden Christian experience of non-duality or non-dual consciousness. So we're inquiring deeply into what non-duality means on the basis of reference points that are there and available to us in centering prayer. And I intended it for basically an audience, three major components. One is particularly for centering prayer aficionados, practitioners, who have been with the practice for a long time and whose experience base is now outpacing the conceptual framework that's been provided in the earlier teaching. Because if you do centering prayer long enough and deeply enough and faithfully enough, as I'm going to argue in the course of this, it will bring you beyond false self, beyond true self, as you typically think of it, into a whole new ballpark, which is classically called, in some of the traditions, witnessing presence, a different feeling of selfhood. And the language that we've used up to this point to support and describe what we're doing in centering prayer and what we're about won't take you across that divide. It takes you up to it, but not beyond it. So I've discovered over and over that there's a lot of people who've been at centering prayer for a long, long time who are actually experiencing some things and understanding some things that don't quite fit in the cognitive roadmaps they're using anymore. So part of this is to try to make some new ground of what happens when centering prayer is really really re-encountered in the place it's already been pushing you to gently all along, which is in non-dual selfhood. We're going to talk about what that means and how you work with it. That'll be a major boost of what we're doing today. The second audience that I'm really working for is a whole bunch of people that are not doing centering prayer, but really need to get a little bit sharper about what centering prayer is, and particularly about what distinguishes it from other forms of meditation practice. So included in this are people that are meditating, but by other paths. You know, whether they're Christian paths or Buddhist paths or whatever, people doing Christian meditation, that wonderful meditation form developed by Don John Bain and now carried forward by Lawrence Freeman, people using various forms of Buddhist practices, Vipassana, metta meditation, people using TM. In other words, there's a whole raft of meditation practices out there. So that's one group of people. One group of people are people that are theologians and historians of religion and spiritual practice. You know, the commentators who have approached the Christian mystical tradition from a theoretical standpoint. And the third is neuroscientists who are increasingly interested in how meditation changes the brain. And in all of these camps, I find a very, very significant misperception. The perception is it's assumed that centering prayer is a sort of generic entry-level form of meditation. And in that sense, like all other forms of meditation, that its purposes are to either focus your mind or relax your awareness. And so they treat it and talk about it as if centering prayer is simply a kind of generic form of mindfulness, while glossing over the unique differences of the method. And when you do that, you completely misunderstand what centering prayer is, how its efficacy works, and where it fits in the great scheme of neuromeditation, how it changes the brain, how it really engages mind-heart. So the assumption that centering prayer is just a Christian name, you know, for mindfulness meditation, big mistake. And I've tried to challenge that by looking at the distinctive features of centering prayer. And I'm going to go there, too. The third group of people that this book may be addressed to is outright beginners. And while I said that the method of centering prayer is still more comprehensively dealt with in my earlier book, still, this book will set it in context so that some mistakes, you know, or they're not mistakes, but they're basically stuck points for a long time that hang people up as they learn the practice of centering prayer, you might be able to get through them more quickly, because you might as well start on the right foot to really understand what centering prayer is and how it does its work, so that you don't spend so much time chasing your own tail, particularly around the question of what's the sacred word and when do you let go of it and how do you let go of it. And that sort of stuff can just keep people in a squirrel cage for 5 or 10 years, you know. I hear the laugh of recognition. Been there, done that. So, but if you know how centering prayer works right from the get-go, you're less likely to get stuck there. So it's for those three reasons that I felt that there was a need to see what centering prayer really is, and really judging it by what it is, not what it is not. To begin to inquire about how it fits and grows out of the great Christian mystical non-dual tradition, and how it sheds light on it and gives you some very unique and efficacious starting points for approaching that tradition. So that's what I'm about in the book. And for me, the two characteristic features of centering prayer that make it distinctly different from other methods of meditation, particularly entry-level methods, if you want to call it that, starter methods for people who haven't been meditating before and want to begin to engage a practice. The first thing, I like to say that most meditation is done on the front end. And centering prayer is done on the back end. Okay, what do I mean by that? Meditation on the front mind, virtually all meditation realizes that the big problem, that the real thing that meditation is supposed to address is what the Buddhists call, picturesquely, monkey mind. Anyway, that our attention goes ricocheting from one thing to another. If there was a bang in the back of the room because somebody dropped a platter of coffee and goodies, all of us would immediately be looking that way. You know, a cell phone rings, you know. Or if something, you know, if something goes off in your head and you start worrying about whether you left the lock the keys into your car or something, all of matter, your attention goes there. So our attention jumps from one thing to another, to another, to another, to another. And all the spiritual traditions say that when your intention is doing that, weathercocking around from stimulus to stimulus, you can't go deeper. You're at the tyranny of this sort of free associative property of your mind, and it keeps you at a certain level. So all meditation has an intention to get you beyond the monkey mind. But most entry-level practices will start by solving this problem, addressing this problem, by giving your attention something very simple to tether itself on or in, like a mantra. So you simply repeat over and over your mantra. In Christian meditation, it's Maranatha, come Lord. Or you tether it in the breath, or you tether it on a body, you know, being present to your feet. The whole idea is you give your attention a tether. And whenever you notice that it's wandering, you bring it back immediately. And if you keep constantly reconnecting with that tether, you can keep your attention from wandering pretty remarkably. So that's typical generic entry-level meditation. Doesn't matter what tradition you're working in, whether you're doing it in a Buddhist mode, a Hindu mode, a TM mode, that's where typical things start. Centering prayer does not start there. It starts on the back end. It assumes that the monkey mind propensity of the mind is going to be working full strength in people. And it simply gives you a mechanism to let go of thoughts once you've been caught. So it doesn't try to damp down or suppress the production of thoughts. It doesn't try to make your mind still. It doesn't try to make your mind focused. It doesn't try to make your mind a blank. It just gives you a simple tool that when the mind does its thing and you get caught by a thought, it gives you a method to release, to let go. So you wriggle out the back end. And in my last book, my big aha moment when I was learning the practice of centering prayer was when I realized that this practice finds its root and ground in solidarity with the theological idea of kenosis, or self-emptying, or letting go, which you find right in that wonderful passage in Philippians 2, 5 following, when Paul says, you also should have in yourselves the same mind that is seen in Christ. And he goes on to describe that mind. Though his state was that of God, he did not deem equality with God something he should cling to, but rather he emptied himself. Well, that's the kenosis word. In Greek, that word for empty yourself is kenosein. And you can see from the context clues that whatever it means in terms of the ultimate divestment of your ego, practically what it means is that it's the opposite of clinging, right? Instead of doing this, he did this. And so it's a foundational practice of letting go. And you practice letting go using your thoughts and your attention. You know, a thought in centering prayer, remember, is anything that draws your attention to a focal point. And it doesn't matter whether it's an image of the Blessed Virgin, a thought, an emotion, a buzz that begins to distract you, an urgent need to stretch out your back or go to the bathroom. If it brings your mind to a focal point, your attention, that's a thought. So in centering prayer, you just let them go over and over and over and over again. And I still think the best centering prayer teaching story was that fabled encounter many years ago between Thomas Keating and a nun who was trying it for the first time. And she was real frustrated. She says, "Father Thomas, I'm such a failure. In 20 minutes of sitting here, I've had 10,000 thoughts." "How lovely," says Thomas, not missing a beat. 10,000 opportunities to return to God. So this is a prayer of return. That's what letting go amounts to. The centering prayer language has been consent to the presence and action of God. They're all covering the same ballpark. It's an idea of when you realize that you're grabbing onto something, glomming onto something, starting to think about it, starting to engage with it, you let it go as a sign, a living practice of not my will, but thine, O Lord, be done. Not my stuff, but thine, O Lord. Of releasing, of letting go, of making space, of non-clinging. So over and over and over again, every time you let go of a thought, you're actually patterning in and imprinting that that capacity to respond to new stimuli in life by you're perfecting the letting go muscle. In solidarity with Christ in Gethsemane, in the practice of kenosis. And this is where centering prayer effects the power of its transformation. So you're relieved of a whole bunch of agendas that really come from other meditation practices. You don't have to try to make your mind still. You don't have to try to make your mind empty. You don't have to try to make your mind focused or a blank. What you do is simply when you catch yourself thinking, you let the thought go. And practice over and over and over and over again this. So that's the first of the patterns, the distinctive method of centering prayer. So what we notice when we actually practice this, if you, not in the period of centering prayer itself, because if you start watching what happens when you release a thought, that would itself be a thought, right? But you can sort of see and you can find from your bodily, you know, from your sensate knowing, that when you release like that, two things happen. First of all, most people will experience when they let go, some sort of a drop or release. Many people physically experience, you know, you drop down deeper in your body. Some experience it more as a going down. Some experience it as an expansion. But there's something that definitely goes on at a micro, subtle, energetic level. And most people experience it as a drop. And it's really interesting because that drop can be picked up neurologically. It really actually does happen. So that's one of the things, that it's at that moment of letting go that when the thing that uniquely happens in centering prayer happens, okay? So good news. I mean, if you're sitting down there and you're besieged by 10,000 thoughts, and even once or twice you manage not to daydream through the whole thing but to let go, you're getting good practice imprinting of this drop motion. The second thing that happens is that between the letting go of one thought and the arising of another, there exists a sliver of time, and it may only be a nanosecond, but nevertheless, it objectively exists, where there's no object, no new thought has arisen, and yet there's still conscious awareness. So there's these nanosecond pauses between the thoughts where your attention is briefly in a configuration which is almost not named in the Christian tradition because it's so subtle that people go blowing right by it. But it's a state of awareness without an object. Or in other words, objectless awareness. And I'm going to do what I do in these books is to take these two markers, the drop that comes with the release, and those brief states of objectless awareness as markers to trace the fact that what centering prayer is actually doing is to lay down the groundwork, not only attitudinally, emotionally, psychologically, but also neurologically, for the beginning of the capacity to run a whole different operating system of perception, a whole different mode of perception, which has traditionally in our in the languaging of the non-dual, particularly as it's been extensively developed in the Buddhist traditions, it's a kind of mode of perception that is characteristic of a non-dual type of awareness. So in other words, what I'm going to claim is that centering prayer is laying down the foundation for a whole kind, different kind of awareness and a whole different kind and sense of selfhood that grows out of that awareness. And it does it incrementally, bit by bit, sit by sit, over 20 or 30 or 40 years of your practice, so that the results and the neurological signature of centering prayer, as well as the fruits of centering prayer in your daily life, are distinctly different from what would be emerging if you were working with a different form of meditation. In other words, these unique characteristics of centering prayer, which most people don't even notice because the commentators are so quick to lop it in, you know, lump it in with all other forms of meditation, because we don't see and appreciate what's happening in these distinct uniquenesses of centering prayer, we don't actually recognize what's going on in the rewiring of our spiritual alignment. So what I really do in this book is to try to trace that through. And I will relate the drop, you know, which can be felt as a distinct shift, a distinct, subtle, energetic transformation. I relate that to the whole Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition of attention in the heart, where the theme song in that, the great tradition of Orthodox hesychism, the prayer of the heart, where the theme song is, put the mind in the heart, put the mind in the heart, put the mind in the heart. And it's clear in these texts that they're not talking about turn off your mental cognitive and get emotional. They're not meaning that at all. There's much description of that that says, you know, the way the Heart Math Institute envisions this is actually closer to what the text is saying. It says, bring the mind down so that the vibrational field entrains with the vibrational field of the heart, so as to form one perceptual unit, working in sympathetic resonance. You know, that's not what the Greek fathers say, but, you know, you can read that into it. They're certainly saying that much more clearly than they're saying, don't get cognitive, get emotional, you know. So it's that this drop is a way of entraining mind and heart, letting go of the kind of cycles and operating systems that that run in the mind, moving beyond the operating system of the mind to the operating system of mind heart. And I'm looking at centering prayer as a way of beginning to actually put teeth in that. What does it mean to get out of the mind and into a deeper place of perception? So that's one of the things I'm looking at. And it's very clear that one of the distinctive features of our Western understanding of non-dual is that it cannot be done by the mind alone. It's not just a higher state or extension of the cognitive line, as it often shows up on maps like spiral dynamics maps or Ken Wilber's maps. It's not just teaching an old dog, the mind, new tricks. It really, in the Christian understanding of it, requires a fundamental foundational shift in the neurology of perception, which involves very clearly bringing heart and mind into entrainment so they form a united field. So I'm going to look at, in my book, how centering prayer really takes us further along that route, precisely by the fact that it's done on the back end and keeps patterning into you this release or letting go, which is the fastest and most effective known route toward heartfulness. So that's, and sorry, that's the part I'm not going to work with you on today, because we can't do everything in a short time today. The other part I want to follow through, and I am going to pick up with you today and also in the retreat, the other is the point that what centering prayer is really about in this instruction to let go of a thought when you have one, and its insistence on that as a fundamental discipline, no matter the quality or beauty or intensity of the thing you're letting go. Its insistence on that is what it's really all about, is reconfiguring our attention so it's no longer flowing in a subject-object configuration, from something you see to an object you're seeing, but is instead gradually learning to hold itself in a whole different way, which I'll unpack for you a little bit more shortly. But you might call it a three-dimensional field of tensile awareness, in which you can become aware kind of globally and holographically without having a specific object of attention. And this is really the operating system that has to kick in for you really to enter non-dual perception as a mode of seeing. So I'm going to trace that through and say that, and looking at it and trying to follow that thread with the help of a well-loved but nearly universally misunderstood Western spiritual classic, The Cloud of Unknowing, which also happens to be the immediate major source of the practice of centering prayer. And so what I'm going to do, and we'll begin to take you through after the break, is to weave back and forth, set up a reciprocal feedback loop between The Cloud of Unknowing as a text, which continues to be inscrutable to most people because its instructions are, you know, seem completely self-canceling and impossible for long stretches of it. So I'm going to go back and forth between that and the actual practices and insights that we pick up from a faithful period of faithful practice of centering prayer. So that in point of fact, centering prayer serves as an avenue into an empirical laboratory and corrective, you know, of the practices laid down in the cloud of unknowing. You ground truth the practices in the cloud of unknowing in centering prayer. And therein lies both the validation of the practices itself and also an interpretive key that can make sense of the cloud in a way that I think scholars have consistently missed for 600 years. Because the thing simply doesn't make sense apart from the grounded practice we have of knowing what goes on when you reconfigure your attention. And I'm going to resketch for you a picture of the cloud of unknowing, not in the usual way that people like to work at it, as a great treatise in the grand tradition of monastic love mysticism, but of the very first Western analysis of the phenomenology of consciousness based on the understanding that there are more than one way of configuring attention. So we're going to look at the cloud that way, aided by the interpretive lens of our practice of centering prayer, and we're going to use our centering prayer to shed light on the cloud. So that's the part we're going to work on in the next, you know, in the next two talks, the one that we'll have later this morning when you're all ravenously hungry, and the talk that we're going to have in the afternoon. That's where I'm going with it. Anyway, just before we take a break today, I want to review for you just really practically, without yet opening the cloud of unknowing, some of the things that we learn in centering prayer just from sweating bullets on the mat, you know. And so in centering prayer, what are you actually doing during a prime time of prayer? Well, you're consenting to the presence of action of God, yeah, yeah. You're resting in contemplative stillness, yeah, yeah. Those are wonderful theological explanations of what you're doing. But what are you actually doing moment by moment to moment? Well, what you're actually doing is releasing thoughts. You're either releasing thoughts or daydreaming. You know, but sometimes when you're not daydreaming, you're releasing thoughts. Sometimes quite a lot of them. Sometimes one after another and after another. So centering prayer is this repeated pattern of you catch yourself thinking, you let the thought go, and of course in the spirit of consenting to the presence and action of God. Every time you release the thought, you let it go, you're exercising. You know, this is what it means to consent. This is what it means to let go. But you put teeth in that general idea, oh, I'm consenting to God's presence in my life. Doesn't that sound nice? The way you put teeth in it is to let go of the damn thought when you're thinking it. No matter how enticing it is, how beautiful, how much it seems to be sent to you direct from the Blessed Virgin, letting go, letting go, letting go. Letting go, 10,000 opportunities to return to God without self-recrimination, without running the tape of, wow, I'm so lousy at this practice. Sit down and let go. So that's what you're actually doing. And remember in centering prayer, a thought is anything that brings your attention to a focal point. And in that, centering prayer is directly reflecting the teaching in the cloud of unknowing. So a thought can be a thought, for example, but it can also be a lot of other things. It can be an emotion, a patch of deep anger or sadness, a retrieved memory, a vision, an illumination, or something purely physical, an itch on your nose. A cell phone buzzing on the other side of the room. If it brings your attention to a focal point, it's a thought. And what do the guidelines in centering prayer say? Let it go. when you realize that you're engaged with a thought, you let it go, you know, you return ever so gently this to the sacred word. Now, just a little bit of a heads up and reinforcement here. You do not replace the thought with the sacred word in the sense that you don't start thinking about the sacred word. You know, the sacred word functions very much like, as my daughter pointed out, it's a windshield wiper, you know? That all it does, you're not supposed to start focusing on the windshield wiper or you're going to hit the telephone pole, you know? All you do is let it wipe the screen clean, okay? It takes a little bit of finesse to learn to do that. And at first, you're thinking about your, you know, well, I'm going to use my centering prayer words, my sacred word, and focus on that. Abba, Abba, Abba. But no, it flicks it clean. Flicks it clean. Allowing that nanosecond where there is no thinker, no thought, but pure awareness. Okay? So centering prayer, you know, is very, very hard-nosed. It does not matter what the thought is. It's not about the quality of the thought. It's about the configuration of your attention. And this is the hardest thing for people to really agree to, you know, particularly remember when you've got that the centering prayer introductory workshop and you go through, and I think the third talk, the kind of thoughts that will make a play for you. And the ones that are everybody's, you know, bugaboo are the insights and illuminations. You sit down there and you're in your centering prayer and it's peaceful and it's quiet. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you get this beautiful vision of, you know, what it feels like to be swimming around inside the Trinity. Or if you're a preacher trying feverishly to get that sermon together before tomorrow morning, you get the final punchline for your sermon. Whoa, where'd this come from? Or a great insight into your being. And of course, the whole intention, you want to put the prayer on the pause button and quickly think about this. Capture it. Write it down. Reflect on it. Because it seems to be so God-sent. Okay? I actually had a rather sharp and pointed conversation with an abbot of a rather conservative Episcopal monastic order who challenged me on this and said, if God is going to be polite enough to come all the way out of his way to give me an insight, I'm certainly going to be polite enough to show up and listen to it. But you see, the thing is, and Thomas Keating is absolutely right there, although the teaching feels real hard-nosed at first, we are predisposed in our culture to think about meditation, or think about silence, as a backdrop for receiving content. And this goes right back to the Old Testament when, you know, the guys wandered off into the desert, but the God was not in the whirlwind or the fire, but God was in the still small voice. Bring it on, you know. So we got this skew anyway towards messages towards God, from God, that got rebooted by Carl Jung, bless his heart, when he saw silence as basically the gateway into the unconscious. And the unconscious is the way of receiving information from our archetypal self. So everybody goes in with the kind of, is God going to give me some sort of message about me? And so when Thomas says, you know, drop it. It doesn't matter. You know, that wonderful phrase he says with his full monastic Trappist beanie on and his flowing white robes. And he says, if the Blessed Virgin herself should come up and offer to pluck that thorn from your side, the answer is, not now, dearie. I'm doing my centering prayer. Ouch! But, and that instruction is almost incomprehensible while you're still using that old mock, that the purpose of the silence is for God to send you a bouquet. And as long as you're still thinking about it that way, you're going to be pretty grouchy about having it wrested out of your hand by this stupid instruction. But you see, what really is at stake is not the message you receive, but it's the configuration of the attention. That as soon as you go out and bite it, I have this something here that I'm going to do you, your attention goes right out to the thought, right? And you glom onto it, you know? And your attention works in a subject-object configuration again, right back there. So, and it's really interesting because most of us don't really know that there's any other configuration for your attention. You know, when I say pay attention, you'll immediately say, to what? We can't imagine attention without an object. Yeah, that's true. The cognitive mind cannot imagine attention without an object. And therein lies the barrier between the realms, between the narrative, the finite, and the non-dual. Because in our whole cataphatic, finite world and the sense of selfhood that grows out of it, attention has to have an object. But there's another way of holding attention, and our tradition has known it very well, although the language they use to describe it is very easily misinterpreted, misunderstood. And the way I like to let you picture this is, remember the good old days when we had mercury thermometers? And you could smash the thermometer and out would come the mercury? And remember the magical thing about mercury? That it can lie splat like a puddle, behave like a liquid, but it can also weeble around making those little balls that wiggle. In other words, it can hold an energized three-dimensional shape. What if your attention was exactly like that? What if we're used to your attention being in that splat liquid form, connecting subject and object on essentially a horizontal plane? What if that's basically the way the operating system of your mind works? It's the system you were programmed into, you know. But what if there's another way of holding attention that becomes more like that live, tensile, three-dimensional, vibrating weeble of a mercury ball? And what if that way of holding your attention has a decidedly different property? In other words, rather than having an object of awareness that you focus on, like focusing your flashlight on a single point, that it can become globally, holographically aware of everything that's going on within the tensile sphere of that attention without having a specific object. Suppose that's possible. And suppose that that's actually a higher vibratory state. You know, it's an energized state of awareness. And suppose that's what's really meant when the Eastern Orthodox tradition speaks of vigilance or nepsis, or attention of the heart. And when the Western tradition speaks of recollection, it doesn't mean that you're thinking vigilantly and alertly about something, focusing that scrunchy energy of your forehead right on it. It means that with the attention deeply grounded in the heart as the epicenter of a three-dimensional sphere, your attention forms itself as a tensile space of non-dual, objectless awareness in which deep perception occurs and in which there actually is content imparted and content retrievable, but you can't retrieve it by the usual methods of the mind. You have to match the state. Suppose this is all true. And suppose that this is what they've been talking about all along when they're talking about putting the mind in the heart, talking about vigilance, when St. Teresa is talking about the prayers of simple recollection of presence. Not a lot of thinking, but not, it just doesn't mean, alpha state emptiness. It's a very, very intense alertness. A field of tensile alertness that corresponds profoundly to the, if you want to call it that, the information flow that doesn't originate on this plane, but connects us in a profound way with the heart of God and with a divine knowingness. Okay, suppose this is true. Worth a wager. I remember one day that it really formed a turning point in my own centering prayer practice. We were doing a retreat at Vancouver School of Theology. And it was a centering prayer intensive of the good classic style, you know, that triple sits three times a day. And it was in the middle sit, in the middle of the three sits, in the middle of the three sits a day, in the middle of the week, when all of a sudden, I was sitting there in that, you know, deep silence, and this amazing thought bubbled up out of nowhere. I mean, it was good. I swear it was good. And I, you know, being compulsively mental, I went to grab at it, and just before I did, I realized that if I did that, I was immediately going to be caught like a fish on a hook, dragged back into the known world of subject-object mental operations. And I could experience that wherever I was in that centering prayer, that it was a state that was more gathered, more alive, more rich, more real, more connected than anything I could hope to gain by going back up into that middle cognitive mode and grasping at straw. And so for the first time, mea culpa, I voluntarily and gladly let go of a thought, even though it was a big piece of juicy bait. Not just begrudgingly, you do the practice and the practice will transform you, but because I could actually viscerally experience the difference between the two states of aliveness in my being. And I knew that wherever the ship was headed, it was headed into that deeper aliveness. And it was on that day that my whole practice of centering prayer began to shift around. And while I wouldn't say that I have become a master of deep attentionality, I can say that I catch myself daydreaming a lot faster, a lot more promptly, and return to that diffuse awareness a lot more quickly, because I know at this point, I know beyond doubt that there's nothing to be had in the empty vase of thought. I can certainly, you know, when I'm happy to come out of centering prayer, pick up thinking again and have fun with it. Nothing's lost. You know, I don't turn mentally incapacitated. The cognitive mind is a great tool for navigating the world. But I know that identity lives at a different level. I want to finish this first talk by just reading a few paragraphs about centering prayer, about a page or three paragraphs in the book about this. You know, when you hit that place of deeper vibratory awareness, it feels like a place you go to. You recognize it, but you don't stay there. And I'll pick up there. It says, at first it feels like a place you go to, my inner wellspring. And your ego self comes with its bucket to fill itself up. But that is merely because attention is still weak. Objectless awareness is a higher vibrational state. It requires energy to hold yourself there. But there is a learning curve here, and the system gradually acclimates. The closest analogy I can come up with here is in studying a foreign language. Let's say you're learning Spanish. For the first several months, when you hear a phrase in Spanish, you first mentally translate it back into English to make sense of it. Then you mentally retranslate it back into Spanish to respond. But there's a time in your mastery of the language when the translation mechanism finally drops out. You hear directly in Spanish and respond directly in Spanish. The contemplative life is like that as well. For a while, yes, our ego self, our narrative self, our small self, whether it's true or false, does indeed appear to be the stable operator. We draw our water from the spiritual well and then bring it home to translate it into all the benefits it confers in our daily life. From there, we translate our thanks back to the God in the form of wordless or spoken prayers. But there comes a time when the ego translator drops out, and we are simply there, hearing and responding directly in the native language of being. There is oneness, and that is fundamentally what is meant by non-dual consciousness. Then this inner wellspring is no longer a place you go to, it's a place you come from. It's a whole new structure of consciousness that can perceive without first splitting the field. From this perspective, it's a bit disheartening to acknowledge that the vast bulk of our Christian spiritual literature, devotional experience, mysticism, and spiritual practice operates solidly within the realm of separated or translator consciousness. Even our highest vision of spiritual attainment, the unitive state, is typically described in affective metaphors, such as mystical marriage, leading one to believe that there is an ecstatic consummation of my soul in God, the highest possible state of beatific splendor and grace. But non-dual consciousness is not a state. It's not a mystical experience. It's not necessarily blissful. You can't attain it. You can't come back from it transformed because there is no you left to be transformed. It's not an intensification of union. It's simply a quiet erasing of the line that divided the field in the first place. I know that's a tough bite for Western minds to swallow. We so want to have our cake and eat it too, to be transformed and live to tell the tale. But beneath all the surface chatter, there is a wholly different sphere of awareness, a different sphere of selfhood, a different sense of God's presence, a different way of relating to our human tasks that doesn't go through the translating mechanism of the separated self having experiences of oneness. We don't hear a lot of people talking about it in Christianity. Meister Eckhart is clearly talking about it. In our own times, Bernadette Roberts is talking about it. And I believe the cloud of unknowing is also talking about it, but in ways that we've barely begun to appreciate. And with that, stay tuned for talk two. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, y'all. So we're going to take about a 20-minute break. Have your coffee, your tea, your whatever, and then we'll be back here about 11:05 for some time of centering prayer, okay?